Okay, shall we start? It is a pleasure to introduce Eric Schleser from Amsterdam, who's going to talk to us today about synthetic philosophy restatement.
Thank you. First of all, thank the Society for inviting me, I think it's about 5 years ago, and for keeping the invitation open through the pandemic and long COVID and everything else. I've been told by English friends that this is an honor, and it feels like an honor. So this is a somewhat unusual paper, because unusual in two ways. I actually go back to something I've published before and try to say it again. And my presentation today is going to tell you why I'm interested in the topic and what really is, I think, driving this project. And I'm not going to follow the order of the paper. The paper itself is, I think, fairly tightly put together, but as the stairway suggests, this paper will have some centrifugal forces in the presentation, centripetal forces in the presentation. So I'm going to introduce you to the talk, then I'm going to explain you my motives for thinking and talking about synthetic philosophy. Then I'm going to tell you about what I tried to say in 2019. I don't know if you know the producers, but my favorite line in that musical and movie is, "We've got a hit," you know. So this paper started to go viral on the internet, it's been cited, people have discussed it, and what's worse is people have discussed it approvingly, while, in my view, misunderstanding its main point, which is kind of a, you either decide to keep quiet, or in this case, I'm using the Aristotelian Society to restate what I'm doing. And then I'm going to give you a very long digression. In fact, the heart of tonight's presentation is a reinterpretation of Plato's Republic, because I think, somewhat surprisingly, at least to me, the themes I'm interested in are present in the Republic, and they're present in a way that the secondary literature hasn't actually really assimilated. And so this is also a modest contribution to Plato reception. And then I'll offer you a new characterization of synthetic philosophy at the end, which, if you'll pay attention, is very close to the original statement, but with a new kind of framing and a new kind of emphasis. Okay, so what I'm first going to do is I'm going to give you some reasons to be interested in synthetic philosophy. Then I'm going to talk about the advanced division of cognitive labor. That's a very long phrase for specialization or hyper-specialization or intellectual hyper-specialization. These I'm going to treat as rough synonyms. And I'm going to assert, not argue, that these generate rather big social, political, and epistemic challenges, and as the economists like to say, externalities. And what I'm going to suggest by my rereading of the Republic, that this is explicitly thematized in the Republic and rather foundational to how Plato presents Socrates' activity in the Republic. So that's kind of a Whiggish, but I think authentic reinterpretation of the Republic. And in fact, what's important for the general argument, at least as an interpretation of the Republic, but also how we're going to think about what synthetic philosophy is that there are really two models in the Republic. There are actually more, but there are two main models in how to think about the relationship between philosophy and the other sciences, and philosophy and this hyper-specialization and the problem of politics lurking behind this. That sounds vague now, but it will become more precise. In the paper that is in on the website, I actually discuss Philip Kitcher's evolution of his views on this issue as well. Tonight, I'm just going to hand wave and say why I think he's not the right route. But I'm not going to offer you arguments for that. And so if you're interested in that, you're going to have to read the paper. But some of you may know his work, and I want to be clear on why I differ. And then one surprising payoff of my narrative is that the idea that sciences and philosophy have only recently separated, that comes out to be a kind of optical illusion. That philosophy is this mother that gives birth to the sciences, and since the scientific revolution, and then once a problem gets solved, it splits off into an empirical science. I want to claim that that's a myth. And it might even be a myth that we owe to Plato, but that's not, I'm really indebted, that's not really my concern tonight. But that it is a myth is important for me, and it's a bad myth. Okay, so that's quite a lot. You're gonna start dancing about 10 minutes before, great. So I had four main motives to start writing and talking about synthetic philosophy. It's a little review article in Biology and Philosophy. It's a review of Dan Dennett and Peter Godfrey Smith. And I embed my review in a larger narrative. I was given a lot of space. In fact, I was told to write a New York Review of Books style of article, and so I went for it. And much to my amazement, it's gone viral, it's been cited, etc. Lovely experience. But my main interest in writing it is that with the interest in meta-philosophical themes of the last 20 years, what philosophy is, what its methods are, philosophy of science and philosophy of the special sciences come out as oddballs. They come out either as bad philosophy, not rigorous philosophy, and doing something somewhat off-center. The reason why it's oddball is that because it has the word science in there, this quasi-high status in the discipline, but when you look at how people in metaphysics and epistemology and philosophy of language, whether they're, again, a complex case, how they talk about philosophy of sciences, it's quite clear that there's a divide, and also they're not reading each other. And in fact, if you look within philosophy, a lot of the sciences get really negligible attention altogether. There is practically no work in philosophy of political science, philosophy of chemistry, or some philosophy of sociology. These are really very neglected fields in philosophy, and that's also odd. My second reason to talk about this, and today I'm going to spend much more time on that one after the setup, is that the extensive division of labor, hyper-specialization, creates important social problems and also problems for philosophy, but also problems in, you know, the real world. And in fact, the problem that I want to put my finger on, because I think Socrates in the Republic puts his finger on it, is that the uptake of specialist knowledge in the political sphere is actually problematic when people don't understand what the specialists are talking about. That's really the issue I'm interested in. Is it me or is it very hot? Of course, my microphone is on here. Another reason, and this is more autobiographical, the field that I was trained in, history and philosophy of science, is pretty stagnant in professional philosophy these days. If you violently disagree with me over that, good for you. I won't defend this, but I think this is a real problem. Hao-Zhen Chung is wonderful, lovely. You can argue that he is the exception that proves the rule. That's also fine. And the other reason why I got interested in this is that I work in a grant environment, and we need to explain what we're doing to the grant agencies, and this is an opportunistic way to create a citation trail for what we're doing. I won't apologize, but I am embarrassed, so enough said. So what I'm going to do is I want to talk a bit more about these first two motives before I get into the nub of the matter. So, the last 20 years has been a lot of self-reflection on the methods of philosophy, so-called meta-philosophy, and when you pay attention to that, what philosophers of the special sciences are doing doesn't fit that easily. Traditionally, analytic philosophers claim that they're interested in creating necessary conditions sufficient for generalizations. More recently, Lord Bull and Timothy Williamson have argued that we're interested in modeling conceptual space or modal space. Daniel Stoliar has tried to argue that we're interested in a certain kind of argumentative pattern where we learn which premises of an argument or of a dilemma or trilemma to reject. And when you think about all these templates that meta-philosophers are saying, analytic philosophers are doing today, contemporary specialist philosophers of the special sciences don't really fit in that well. That's okay for a philosopher of physics because nobody understands what they're saying anyway, but for the rest of them, it is a real problem. Now, interestingly enough, when you talk to scientists who are interested in philosophy of science, I actually go to conferences like that, they love what philosophers of science are doing because it looks like we're offering them helpful conceptual clarification, even though other philosophers will say we're not really all that conceptually clear at all. And then in the latest twist, people like Williamson especially, they're appealing to philosophy of science in their own meta-philosophy, while simultaneously not having real space for philosophy of science, right? So there's all kinds of twists here that I'm not going into. But the bottom line is philosophy of science has this awkward position in the professional self-understanding. That's what I want you to at least take on board as a motive. My second motive really takes off from a book by Elijah Milgram, The Great Endarkenment, which is a book that has a hyper-awareness of the ways in which hyper-specialization hinders philosophic communication within the discipline, across the sciences, and across society. In fact, he thinks that this gets actually thematized in the Tower of Babel, Babylon, story in the Old Testament. I'm not entirely on board with that, but it's a lovely attempt. Crucially then, there are a lot of linguistic and cognitive barriers between and within the sciences and within philosophy as we hyper-specialize. And that has an important effect. I'm going to use a somewhat special terminology. That means that most of our beliefs are actually authoritated by other experts, if we're intellectually responsible, right? That this is based on testimony, and it's no surprise that epistemologists are very nervous about testimony. But this also generates some predictable problems in the sciences more generally. If we don't really understand what other scientists are talking about, even within the sciences, we get vulnerable to things like the replication crisis. I'm not saying that's the only reason, because incentives matter as well, but that's another story. But more interestingly for me, it generates problems for administrators, grant agencies, governments, journalists, because they can't really tell which experts they should be listening to. And all, if you don't believe me, just remember the first year of the pandemic. Actually, I think to this day, we haven't solved yet how we should have thought about the pandemic. But which policy advisor to listen to became a real problem. I've written on that myself as well. But also, for the academics here, I think it also helps explain why our bosses tend to start focusing on procedure and often sound so hollow in their jargon. It's because they're terrified of looking like idiots when they're talking about hyper-specialized fellow academics. They literally can't tell and can't judge whether we know what we're talking about. And in fact, my other favorite example of this is, I think this shows up in science journalism and journalism about our own field. We love all the fancy newspapers until they start talking about our own discipline. And then we think, huh, they don't really understand what they're talking about. And then occasionally there's somebody who does, and we all admire them. Right? And it's also the reason why judges and administrative law and our own grant agencies, they're really hyper-focused on procedure, because they know they can't make any substantive judgments. They have to farm that out. And then they hope that they farm it out to the right people, or the right metric, or the right procedure. Okay, so that's the diagnosis. In 2019, as I was writing about Dennett and Godfrey Smith and Rachel Carson, I wanted to say that there is a way of thinking about philosophy of science that's different than what analytic philosophers are doing, and that's distinctive. And it really was a kind of twofold characterization. I wouldn't call this a definition. So my first attempt, synthetic philosophy is a style of philosophy that brings together insights, knowledge, and arguments from the special sciences with the aim to offer a coherent account of complex systems and connect these to a wider culture or other philosophical projects or both. This is important. This I call the synthetic loop part of the characterization. Synthetic philosophy may in turn generate new research in the special sciences, a new special science connected to the framework adopted in the synthetic philosophy, or new projects in philosophy. Right, so qua thing, it's one thing, but it can connect many things to other things. So one useful way to conceive of synthetic philosophy is to discern in it the construction of a scientific image, Sellars' famous phrase, that may influence the development of the special sciences, philosophy, public policy, or the manifest image. Right? So this part of my characterization is the integrative conception of synthetic philosophy. There must be some joke about going hermeneutic on oneself, but for reasons of exposition, I have to do it. Right, and so the integrative conception of synthetic philosophy creates a single scientific image of different specializations. And this people loved. This is what my readers thought I was endorsing, and what I think philosophers of science are doing. And that was a bit of a problem, because a few pages later in the paper, we're really talking about a very short paper after all, I also say the following. Synthetic philosophy requires a general theory, such as Darwinism, or game theory, or information theory, or perhaps Bayes' theorem, that is thin and flexible enough to be applied in different special sciences, but rich enough that when applied, it allows for connections to be developed among them. And this is the integrative glue. And my interest in synthetic philosophy, while I like the integrating part, is really in what the nature of the glue. And much to my sadness, this part of my paper didn't get uptake. It's all the first part, not this part. And at the time, I argued that a lot of prominent Darwinian philosophers actually were synthetic philosophers in this A and B sense. They did a lot of A, but they also did B. And that as a group, they gave birth to new projects in philosophy, but also in science, right? So that against the myth that philosophy only births science and then it splits off, I want to say that it could loop back on itself in various ways, and that synthetic philosophers can do that work for philosophy and science. In the paper, I noted that one doesn't need to be a Darwinian in order to be a synthetic philosopher. It just so happened that my case study was all Darwinian philosophers, but that also, in the update, got a bit lost in the noise. Right? So here I'm saying again, you can be a synthetic philosopher and reject Darwinism. Okay, so these were my exemplars then. Interestingly enough, something about the zeitgeist must have been in the air, because in a parallel track, Thomas Pradet, French philosopher of science and a biologist, had been arguing along very similar lines in papers that started to come out in 2019 as well, and then in a bunch of other papers. His terminology is different than mine. The actual conception is subtly different, but he's very interested in the role that philosophy can have within the sciences, and then looping back the role of those sciences again back into philosophy, right? So I just want to note that there's other ways to approach these issues. Okay, so first thing to say before I start breaking new ground, I was partially anticipated by Tim Lewis in a very nice paper that I wasn't aware of, Mea Culpa, but he actually gets there first. Already said this. And then the other thing I noticed in responses to my paper is that people were saying to me, hey, you sound like Philip Kitcher, do you really want that? Now, I'm an admirer of Philip Kitcher, and I would have ordinarily said yes, but in this case, I actually realized, no, that was not what I wanted to sound like, because he's a Dewey-style pragmatist, and if you like Dewey-style pragmatism, that's great. But the reason I didn't want to sound like Kitcher is that his account of synthetic philosophy actually uses the same phrase for similar reasons like me, because we're both harking back to the 19th century in some important respects, is that on his account, where the synthesis comes from is left mysterious. In fact, it often looks like it's the creative intellectual genius philosopher who's doing the synthesizing. And that I don't like. I reject that way of thinking about philosophy. I'm on Team No Heroes, as Liam Kofi Bright would say. In particular, I want to say that the synthetic philosopher actually has expertise, and genuine expertise, connected to that synthesizing glue, namely that general theory. That's why I reject the Kitcher approach. Now, Kitcher himself must have seen some of, I don't want to say he read me, but he must have seen some of the problems with his own view, because in his latest book, he really tries much harder to domesticate what he thinks synthetic philosophy is, but at the bottom, it still requires an act of faith, a leap, some kind of intellectual step that he doesn't make transparent, and that's why I'm not happy. This is a half a slide in the paper. It's half my paper, so if you're interested in the real arguments, you're going to have to read the paper. I apologize. Okay, let's go to Plato. A bit more fun anyway. So I think it's well known that the Republic is built around the advanced division of cognitive labor. That's rather important to it, but I'm going to remind you of it. It's the cause of all political life. This is explicitly set at the beginning of Book 2 when he introduces the healthy city or the city of pigs. In fact, the division of labor is itself a response to human diversity in Socrates' origin account. And he's quite explicit that this diversity is also cognitive in character, as you well know probably. Socrates creates a natural inequality among humans. Where they're very smart people by nature and not so smart people by nature. It's not so gendered in the Republic, that's good, but it's still rather hierarchical. And in fact, the Kallipolis, the excellent city, the beautiful city of the Republic, is structured around the idea that what can create a caste and breed fantastically smart people to rule things. Right? That's really rather important to the Republic. And it's not just breeding, it's also a long period of education. Obviously, in fact, all the sciences you have to study, and then once you've studied them and you're rather old, you can have a shot at being a philosopher king. Okay, now, the ship of state is a rather well-known parable in the Republic, and there's a lot to be said about it, but its main point is to argue that democratic elites are disastrous in two ways. Number one, they generally claim that there's no skill in piloting the ship of state. And number two, when they go, you might say, populist or demagogic, they'll say that the people with real skill don't have it, and that they themselves or the people they like do have it. Very salient again. My students always recognize our contemporary moment. But crucially, the owner of the ship, the public, the demos, cannot recognize real skill even when it is face-to-face to it. That's the real, or at least one of the real tragedies of the ship of state that Socrates diagnoses. And this issue actually comes back in a very complicated dialogue, The Statesman, where there is no Socrates. And it's also an issue that recurs over and over again in the polemics with the sophists. Right? So this is not just an incidental moment in the Republic. It's actually a non-trivial obsession in Plato's writings. And my interest today is to remind you of book, then of the Republic, and then an exchange that's certainly been overlooked. So in book 10, before we get to Myth of Ur, Socrates returns to the censorship of the poets. He had already argued for the censorship of the poets in books 2 and 3 of the Republic because they corrupt the young. In book 10, they still corrupt the young, but a new source of corruption comes in. And the bottom line is the argument that Socrates trots out is we should get rid of the poets in the city because they don't know what they're talking about. They literally are ignoramuses and spreading fake news. And that's important because in Greek life, the poets are really the major producers of culture, and they're not in our age, highfalutin topic. Maybe in England less so than in Holland, I should say. The reason why they are set to know nothing is that they lack this threefold distinction between knowledge, lack of knowledge, and imitation. And it's actually quite interesting why Socrates would think that, but I'm going to set that aside because I'm going a bit slow anyway. But what's crucial for my purposes is that Socrates' argument about the poets in Book 10 generalizes to all speakers to the public who don't know what they're talking about. It's not just the poets, right? And in our day, it's a long list of people with degrees, right? And if you're one of them, I apologize. You have a skill, but it's not this particular skill. I don't want to say that the situation is hopeless for Socrates. In fact, you may recall he has a minor obsession with building chairs and sofas. And he does think that actual sofas, they're users of it, can figure out if sofas are doing what they're made for. Right? So it's not that nothing, that he's a skeptic about all of this, but about general knowledge of expertise, he is worried that we will be fooled. That's the point. Now, for my purposes, what's rather important in Book 10 is that among the topics of the poet's ignorance are the greatest and most beautiful things, quite an interesting list, warfare, generalship, city government, or public policy, and education. These are the things that the poets don't know what they're talking about, they're taken serious as experts, and they're creating confusion about real expertise. Right? And obviously, for today's talk, the city government part or public policy part is rather important. And that echoes the ship of state, right? So I feel like I've established this is a theme that runs through the Republic, and now I get to the part that I want to talk about a little bit more in depth. So I teach the Republic every year or every other year, and this year I stumble over this long passage, a guy called Damon, who has specialist knowledge about poetry, and there's a whole technical vocabulary that some of you may not understand, but actually I don't know what it means. And Damon is introduced as a technical expert on the representational qualities of music or rhythms, and its role in character development. Right? Why that's the case, I'm gonna bracket for a second. And then Socrates says, look, we're gonna appeal to Damon here for two reasons. Number one, we wanna save some time, and so we know who has real knowledge on this. And number two, Damon has knowledge that Socrates doesn't have. Now, as you can tell already, Damon's expert terminology is part of the issue here because that's a barrier to understand. You have to understand what he's saying in order to see the claim he's making. And I myself, in the paper, I explain why. I think Socrates' skill at dialectics is one of his means at figuring out whether he's dealing with a real expert or not a real expert. Right, and I'm gonna bracket that for now, but keep that in the back of mind. Now, I should say this passage, when it attracts attention of, let's call it mainstream commentators on the Republic within philosophy, there's a real debate whether Socrates is being ironic or not, or satirical, because Damon is kind of associated with sophism. Right, so this is not clear we can take Socrates at his word here, according to some interpreters, insofar as anybody pays attention to it. I actually thought Damon was an invented character, and we'll get to that in a second. Now, Interestingly enough, a book later, Socrates returns to Daemon and makes a really striking claim. For a change to a new type of music is something to beware of as a hazard. Right? If you're going to start innovating in culture, you're potentially destabilizing society. That's the real worry here. For the modes of music are never disturbed without unsettling the most fundamental political and social conventions, as Daemon affirms, and I'm convinced. So Daemon is the authority on this topic that connects music to political stability, culture to musical stability in our terminology. And if you shift the culture, if you start innovating, you risk politically destabilizing society. That's the claim. Socrates affirms in his own voice, but appeals to Daemon as the authority. And there's nothing ironic or satirical about this, because this is central to Plato's argument in the Republic. And actually, nobody's ever suggested it would be satirical. Now, interestingly, Daemon's authority is basically accepted here. Right? It's not merely an appeal to authority, because Socrates has a lot of his own arguments, but Daemon is the authority. You probably know, but musicology, music theory is a very old science. It's not quite clear if Daemon himself had conceived of it as mathematical. I think the expert opinion is not. But it became a mathematical study. But crucially for my purposes, Daemon's expertise is central to the art of government. He tells you a key causal factor of whether how to run city administration and political life, and whether you can innovate or not. You said that. Good. Now, once you pay attention to it and you start tracing out references to Daemon, they're always respectful in all of Plato's literature. In fact, Daemon's teacher, Prodicus, also generally gets positive references. So the idea that Plato's always against the sophist, that has to be taken a bit more nuancedly, particularly when it comes to Daemon. Now, turns out I'm not the only person fascinated by Daemon once I notice this. This is from Plutarch. Plutarch's Life of Pericles. He introduces Pericles, and then he gives this aside before he goes into the main topic. Daemon seems to have been a consummate sophist, Plutarch says, but to have taken refuge behind the name of music in order to conceal from the multitude his real power is a kind of Straussian reading of Plutarch going on here. Daemon, I'm not interested in that. He associated with Pericles, that political athlete, as it were, in the capacity of rubber and trainer. However, masseur, we would say, I think. However, Daemon was not left unmolested in his use of his lyre as a screen, but was ostracized for being a great schemer and a friend of tyranny, and became the butt of comic poets, right? So there is, in fact, an ancient interest in Daemon. And unsurprisingly, the classical scholars and the musicologists have an interest. Okay, so here's what I want you to take away. On my reading of the Republic, there are really two models of how to think about the relationship between philosophy and the division of the sciences and political life. One is the best model, or the Kallipolis, which requires a total reorganization of society, where an elite group of experts is bred, requires a long training, esprit de corps. You may know property is abolished, men and women hang out together, there's censorship, and in particular, the censorship prevents the distortions of what Neil Levy calls the epistemic environment, right? And it's crowned by the philosopher kings, and this is really explicitly theorized in the middle books of the Republic. And then there's this imperfect model, which is, I think, instantiated by the representation of Socrates, who operates within the division of cognitive labor in this imperfect society, where different expertises partially can keep each other honest, but also are, because they're partially overlapping, but also have to defer on occasion. Right, and this kind of anticipates Polanyi's philosophy of science. I'm not interested in defending that, but it's kind of neat. And then Socrates' own skill facilitates these partial overlaps. Right? And I'm claiming this is left to the reader. I've just presented it to you. Okay, and once you think about it, these two models are not the only way to think about the relationship between philosophy, hyper-specialization, and social and political life. I've put a bunch of famous ones on the screen. This is encyclopedism, this is Diderot, H.G. Wells. In Germany, this is theorized by Leibniz, but we have it now as the Max Planck Institutes. Government creates these highly specialized research tanks. We have the Dutch and American and British system of this kind of hierarchical system of credentialing. You've got the Unity of Science projects, and you've got Bacon's Royal Society project. They all have different ways of handling these issues, right? So this is a gigantic research project, if you're keen on it. Okay, so the upshot of my story now, and I'm gonna go, I think, another 8 more minutes or so, is first of all, I want you to be a bit wary that Socrates is this isolated gadfly. Maybe he was like that in real life. Maybe the early dialogues show us that. But Plato, as a mature, when he represents Socrates in the Republic and also a few other places, actually we see Socrates respectfully engaging with other expertises when they have genuine expertise. In fact, rather importantly for the Republic, when it comes to the religion and theological commitments of the Gallipolis, in many ways, Socrates defers to the Temple of Apollo. Right? So there's, in fact, a much deeper division of labor theorized in the Republic. Okay, so what my main claim is, and this is how I'm now theorizing synthetic philosophy, there is a challenge of securing the fruits of the advanced division of cognitive labor. This is a challenge for any society, short of the Gallipolis. And because there are always highly politicized agents that have good reasons to try to prevent you from having those fruits. That's really a political theorist in me now. And philosophy's role within this division of labor is theorized from the start in the history of philosophy, also in Islamic philosophy I'm familiar with, and also in early modern philosophy. Okay. I told you I don't like the myth that philosophy gives birth to the other sciences. You're familiar with it. ChatGPT is very familiar with it, I noticed, somewhat surprisingly. I would love if one of you, and I recognize a few scholars, could tell me who originates this myth. I mean, that would really be great, in fact. My own hypothesis is that the myth originates in the Enlightenment sometime, Voltaire, Diderot, that universe. But my friend Eric Brown actually thinks that Plato may be the source of the myth, because all the sciences, real sciences in Plato, are philosophical in character. Right? And that should not have been accepted on faith, because there are, in fact, all kinds of sciences in the ancient world that, if they don't predate philosophy, are distinct from philosophy, whatever it was. I like to talk about ancient Babylonian political economy, but botany is well studied. Medicine, of course, is well understood. Geology. In fact, you can go for a whole list of real sciences that have nothing to do in their origin with philosophy, to the best of our knowledge. Right, so it's actually puzzling that the myth of philosophy's birth of other science is so widely accepted in the field. My only explanation for that is a kind of physics envy that philosophers have, but that's a different story. Okay, so let me start wrapping up. Here's how I'm thinking about synthetic philosophy. It's a style or kind of philosophy that presupposes or develops expertise in a general theory, etc., that is thin and flexible enough to be applied in the different special sciences, but rich enough that when applied, it allows for connections to be developed among them, with the aim to offer a coherent account of complex systems and connect these to a wider culture, the science, or the other philosophical projects. Right, so here I really have tried to subdue the the totalizing version of synthetic philosophy as a potential upshot of this, but not the main focus. Now clearly, so conceived, I hope clearly that you agree, synthetic philosophy is a kind of umbrella term. Lots of things on this account will end up being synthetic philosophy. And my current way of thinking about this, I've spelled this out in the paper, is that actually contemporary synthetic philosophy are a kind of hybrid of analytic philosophy with a particular expertise in a particular theory or model or technique. Those are the synthetic philosophers I'm familiar with. Obviously, you could have continental philosophers also be synthetic philosophers in this sense, when they combine their special expertise with a particular method or practice, right? But since I can't speak for them, I won't do so. Importantly, it does not presuppose naturalism. What it presupposes synthetic philosophy is that a particular technique or model or theory that's thin enough to be applied in different contexts can be taught to others without mystery, and can be applied without mystery. That's really key. So that's not sufficient for now. I've given a list of things that can be the synthetic glue, but this is not meant to be imperialistic. There can be a whole list of other things. At the last talk, I gave the category theorist and the homeotype. Type theorists also convinced me that they were synthetic philosophers and so on and so on. I'm not... crucially, however, sociologically, not trivially, on this view, many synthetic philosophers can end up in departments outside of philosophy, and particularly as our, certainly in England, the job market is collapsing. I wouldn't be surprised if border policing will become more robust too, but that's for a different talk. Let me set this. Okay, let me start closing up. Part of the point of this project is to give an identity to a set of practices that now look interesting, but at cocktail parties, not quite rigorous enough. Right? And I'm going to claim, no, they're rigorous. It's just not standard analytic philosophy. Importantly, too, on this view, it's quite natural how philosophy can contribute to ongoing science. Some of us are in that business. The hope is that this also creates a specialist class of philosophers who can communicate with other stakeholders and society about their special and distinct expertise. I'm thinking of people like Anna Alexandrova, Eric Agner, Eric Winsberg, Jacob Stegengaard. There's quite a few people who have genuine expertise in a particular technical, or Richard Pettigrew, in a particular technical area of some technique or model that's used in lots of sciences or lots of disciplines, and those happen to have real salience to the outside world, right? Then somebody needs to help us figure out what that salience is. Reset this. Now, I don't need to say that if you've happened to find the same formal apparatus in different areas, that this is always significant and interesting. I myself have been interested in the use of game theory in political theory, in political science and biology, and I had to end up saying that there really is nothing illuminating, at least for me, to say about that commonality. Right? So it's not always the case that it's interesting. Final two slides, I think. Originally, I really thought of synthetic philosophy as an alternative to analytic philosophy, really like, it's been a century, time to let go of the project. The fact that we're really interested in meta-philosophy should tell us that something is amiss. Here's a new project, right? But in principle, it's compatible with it. In fact, if you're an analytic philosopher and you're worried, I could say, look, what synthetic philosophy does is give you the premises of your arguments, right? So you can see how the two might hang together, if necessary. And in my new restatement, I actually think that this is hybridity, is that the way Socrates draws on dialectics is analogous to the way synthetic philosopher draws on analysis. right? So there, it doesn't have to be incompatible. And finally, I'm not an empiricist. I'm not claiming that synthetic philosophy is the only worthy game in town. Lots of other lovely and beautiful things to do. But I do want to end up with two open problems. Given the non-unity of contemporary science, in fact, many scientists themselves have incompatible models that they use in practice, there's no reason to believe that synthetic philosophers will agree on the way the world is, metaphysics or ontology. Right? In fact, you would expect structural disagreement here. For some of you, that might be a cost that you don't want to pay. And then the other thing that you might be worried about, and that I'm starting to think about myself, is there in fact a more precise way to characterize what a synthetic theory is? Because I've been rather fast and loose in pointing out exemplars, but you might want to give a list of necessary and sufficient conditions, maybe group them in different classes. This is a research project for somebody, perhaps me, but I'm not sure. But that will require also non-trivial case studies. I don't think that can be done from the armchair. Okay, let me wrap here and stop here.
Let's take a 5 or 10 minute break and then we'll come back for